we are back with episode 797 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
This is Gary Lindros, and with... where am I? Oh, D. Scary from Jacksonville. I'm sorry. And, yeah, we have a bunch of shows to go through tonight. Some of them are really good.
Yeah, as you can tell, we are kind of getting back on track after a couple weeks of, a lot of other things going on, but we are going to try and focus and hone in on, well, quite frankly, a whole bunch of episodes here, and some of which we have obviously seen and want to discuss in more detail than others. This week had 23 episodes, 23 different shows, 23 different episodes, so quite a packed week, but we are going to get into it. So before we do any of that, Gary, if you could go ahead and give us a disclaimer.
Yes, it's been at least 2 weeks since these shows have aired, so we're hoping you've had a chance to watch them all and are as excited about some of them as we are. During our discussions, we do talk about final endings, people living, people dying, and progressions that we are enjoying throughout the shows. So if you don't want to be spoiled by that, we're not apologizing, we're just saying be ready.
That's right. All right, well, we are going to, as usual, talk about our bottom three and then our top three and then kind of go into whatever other shows we feel like we have time for. So going all the way down the list to the bottom three, we did have some episodes that were, one episode that was below average, but it is worth mentioning that this week we had a couple episodes that were just short of a perfect 10. So this is a week that has a huge range as far as scores are concerned. Coming in at... Oh, excuse me. I have to actually do something real quick because it turns out that the scores kind of changed on me and I didn't notice that one. In the meantime, Gary, if you could go ahead and do our one of the other shows at the bottom of the list here, our little friend Iron Fist.
We're talking about Iron Fist, Season 1, Episode 3, Rolling Thunder, Cannon Punch. Danny remembers painful moments. Colleen shares her talent. And Joy is the prime example of a wise business person. This came in near the bottom of our scale at a 7. Not horrible, but not great either. I have to say, I felt that the show at this point still does not have a focus. Danny just seems like a gullible, lost boy, and he's not a boy anymore. He's a man, and I realize he might not be wise to the ways of New York City, but at the same time, they're still playing him a little too much of a fool for my tastes, or at least as naive. He should be wise to many things, and he seems to be missing almost everything. And it was okay for the first episode and maybe into the second, but now that we're hitting three, it's getting really old for me, and I'm not saying he has to understand everything, but he just seems like he's walking around like a little puppy wagging his tail, and it's a little tedious for me. We have all these things going into effect, and he's still making an honest effort to try and regain his identity and prove himself, and it's making progress, but geez, it's like pulling teeth. It's happening way too slow for me, and I'm not saying I'm going to drop the show because I plan to watch it throughout, but geez, these episodes are really rough to get through, so I gave it a pretty low score for myself. John, you were a little bit more optimistic with it, but what am I not seeing?
I don't know that you're not seeing anything. I think it's just that I am trying to enjoy it, and maybe I'm giving it a little bit of credit here. I feel like the Meachums were a little bit more interesting. I still think that the brother is way poorly cast. I'll just put it that way. But I feel like Joy and the father are a little bit more interesting here. There is this theme that's emerging in this episode about loyalty and so forth. So there is some effort being made, and I guess maybe I did want to give that a little bit of credit. But I have to say, like you said, Danny just comes across as a complete idiot. Writers, maybe he would seem just a little less of a privileged twerp. I could have used a different word, but I'll be nice. If he wasn't in a class, leading a class of people of color and throwing out a line like, stop being chattering monkeys. Writers, awareness. Because I heard that line and I literally had to pause it and just get up for a few minutes and just go, wow. It's 2017. Really, guys? We're going to throw that out there. Okay. This, again, gives me the impression that this show was put together with roughly 2 to 3 weeks of lead time. Because really, it's like, guys, you really needed another run-through here. Yeah. Just this show, the first three episodes, really not doing a whole lot to justify its existence. I think that I was talking to somebody about it, and we may have mentioned this before, but I'll reiterate. I feel like they would have done much better if they had introduced Danny as a minor character in, say, the Luke Cage miniseries. There, his antics would have been an interesting contrast to Luke, and you could have gotten the whole Heroes for Hire thing going, and it would have made a lot more sense. And maybe given someone like Punisher a go right from the beginning. Either that or just like, okay, great. You originally said, let's make these four the ones that we want to do. Don't feel beholden to that. Like, make an executive decision that, yes, we said that these were the four that we were going to go with, but we feel like we need to make a midstream adjustment. Nobody would have really minded. I really doubt that they would have. So, yeah. This just was, it's still rough at this point. I will say, though, that there is at least a little bit of improvement down the wire. There was an episode that I saw that's a little bit ahead of this that when I was watching it, I was actually nodding and going, this isn't half bad. This would have been a much better way to go. So, yeah. Yeah. So, but this episode was not that episode. To kind of go back to one of the other shows that came in the bottom three, that one, by the way, the Iron Fist episode, got an average 7. Coming in at an average of 7.5, and there were a few episodes that had this average, but I did pick the one that was the most prominent in my mind, and that is Sleepy Hollow, Season 4, Episode 13, Freedom. In the Season 4 finale, Dreyfus finally has enough power to infiltrate the White House, and his group of minions now has the strength to take action, so it's up to Team Witness to stop him once and for all. Yeah, this got a 7.5... And this is one of those episodes that I was referring to during our last episode, where it's to say, it's very clear that they didn't know what the future may or may not be for the series. And so, not knowing what to really do, instead of coming to a hard conclusion, they kind of left some things pretty wide open. They did, resolve the Dreyfus story, but they did leave things open, and that just kind of tells me that, anyone who is holding out hope for a fifth season, and I was stunned when they got a fourth season.
Yeah, so yeah.
Fifth
yeah.
season would just about be a sign itself of the apocalypse. So it's just that unlikely. So yeah, I feel like, yeah, it just equivocated the ending a little bit too much. They could have just had a hard ending and then just came back. It wouldn't have really hurt. I don't know why there are certain producers out there who feel like, if you have a solid conclusion to your season, it's going to convince the studios or the network not to give you another season. That's not why they make a decision. It really isn't. Having an open-ended season finale does not in any way, shape, or form obligate them or make them feel obligated to give you more. So why bother? If you know that there's a chance that it's the end, give it a hard ending. You can always come up with a way to continue it. I'm not saying end the series in such a way or the season in such a way that you cannot in any way continue forward, but don't artificially insert things in there to keep this, give it a cliffhanger when you know that there's a pretty low chance of it being resolved. That's all I'm saying. It just, and this didn't quite do that, but it did enough of it to kind of get on my nerves. That and the fact that just going over the fourth season in general, I just have to say that it's really obvious to me that they would have loved to have told a more expansive story, but they just didn't have the money for it. And so this kind of reminded me of one of those old Doctor Who serials where it ran for, several episodes, but they just did everything they could with what little bit of money they had and then just sold it with the performances and just said, yeah, we're going to act like this is a much more funded show. I'm sure that the folks over at Supernatural sit there and say, guys, we could have given you some help about how to deal with this problem. We've been doing it for a long time. But yeah, they clearly struggled with their lack of a budget, so... there it is. It sucks when they really seem to be struggling more with that than they do with the actual story that they want to tell, like how to do it. It's more like, how can we afford it? So I almost feel like I don't want them to have a fifth season just for that reason alone. I don't want to have to see them try even harder to make a $10 budget work. Because that's what it feels like sometimes. Like, we paid for the people to in the cast. We don't have any money left over for production. So make it work, guys. All right, and that brings us to the other show that was at the bottom three this week, and that is the return of Prison Break, Season 5, Episode 1. Oh, forget it. It's spelled O-G-Y-G-I-A. I have no idea how you're supposed to say that. I even watched the episode, and I still don't know how you're supposed to say that. Regardless, it's been 7 years since Michael Scofield was presumed dead, but when clues suggest that he might still be alive, Lincoln Burrows reunites with Sarah Tancredi to help track down the truth. Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah, so this got an average of 6.75. And actually, it would have ranked higher if it wasn't for Nadine giving it a 6. He says, while the nostalgia factor is fun, this premiere is nowhere near as exhilarating as Prison Break was at its peak. That's true. It's really hard to kind of get that energy back this long after the fact. But for me, it would have even gotten a higher score than the 7.5 I gave it if it wasn't for the fact that a major subplot, the one with Teabag, didn't make much sense. Still, it's really fun because they turn the concept on its head. Michael is in jail. Lincoln is the one that has to try and figure out how to get him out. It's just, I enjoy this cast. I enjoy the whole idea, the whole Prison Break. I really enjoyed the show back when it was on. So, yeah, it's a nice return as far as I'm concerned. I'm not going to say that it's high art, but it's exciting. I think it's doing better already than the 24 Legacy show is doing. So, there you go. But it is really hard after watching Wentworth Miller and the guy who plays Lincoln and Mick. Oh, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Sorry, but that actor who plays Mick on Legends of Tomorrow. After watching them play Captain Cold and Heatwave together, it's really hard for me to see them play.
See them as these characters now?
Yes, because
especially with them interacting with each other. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I keep expecting Lincoln to start chewing the scenery with being all gruff and hilariously blue collar, you know, like stereotypically so. That, yeah, I almost feel like, why is he acting kind of smart? that's not Heatwave. What's going on? And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. It's same actor, different role.
Oh boy.
And I keep expecting Michael Scofield to start, you know, drawing out his lines like Snart does.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to break out of this prison.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Do you feel it's the... So in this case, do you feel it's the story or it's the actors that are really pulling this? Because sometimes it can be one or the other. Sometimes you're lucky and it's both. Is this just purely...
Making it good or making it kind of dragging it down? Which one?
Making it good, raising it up, wanting it to come back. You know, is it just the actors themselves, the story? I have to admit, I intermittently follow the series, but it seemed reasonably played out.
Yeah, it was pretty played out, and I think that they're finding ways to make it interesting and kind of tell the story, but right now I could care less about the story. This is the fun of having these characters back and seeing them do their antics again.
So really, we just need a variety hour with them, is what you're really saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Break out of this. Yeah. Like, okay, we've locked you in a 7-Eleven. Get out. You know, it's...
Well, I mean, they make enough puns about it in Legends already, so...
That's exactly it. They talk about it all the time in Legends of Tomorrow, so yeah. They might as well just pretend that that's what they're doing. That's what it is. They should have Snart and Mick
locked up for an episode. Lock them up in a prison for an episode and see. Yeah,
They should make Prison Break's new season just the spinoff of Legends of Tomorrow. And I think that people would probably have just as much fun with that, if not more. But again, it kind of wound up at the bottom of the list because Nadine was not particularly favorable about the over reliance on nostalgia. So it happens. All right. Well, that means that we are going to go ahead up to our top three. And yes, once again, I'm going to do a quick rearrangement because I just noticed that there were two episodes that were scored identically, but one had more than the other. So I'm just going to really quickly do that. Sure. And so that means that we are going to talk about our number three show for the week, and that is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 4, Episode 16, What If? Lindsay and Simmons uncover secrets and lies in a world gone mad. With Hydra in control, they are our only hope to save everyone. I'm sorry, I called it Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Completely wrong show.
John, thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Please don't send Fitz after me. I really don't want to feel that kind of pain tonight. Thank you. Anyway, this came in at a 9, a great return for its third arc of the season. And Gary, what are your thoughts on this one, first and foremost?
Hail Hydra, just so I don't get in trouble. Yeah. Number one, I love the title throwback to the classic, you know, comic book series. There's actually been a few versions of the What Ifs, but it's basically what this was. It's what if you take something and make a big change? How does the universe shake out afterwards as a result of it? And we really got to see the biggest surprise of all for me was, even though they teased about it the last episode, was actually getting to see Ward again, and not as a monster or anything like that, but actually Ward before he sort of snapped. And I found that I missed Ward more than I really thought I would after what's happened to both him and his body afterwards. I thought I was pretty much done and glad, good riddance. But I enjoyed, I guess, the old team back together again. It was, you know, the ways they come up to bring this man back time after time are incredible. That being said, we have a really crazy world. One of the more interesting things I thought was Jenna. She was obviously riddled with bullets in this simulation and buried, I guess, in a mass grave at S.H.I.E.L.D. Academy. And she pulls herself literally out of the dirt. That was quite interesting. A lot of the stuff was, it was odd. It was mixed between a complete police state and then some degrees of freedom, which was interesting that I felt like they did, like the idea that Jenna could actually move around at all seemed amazing to me, given all the various drones and other technologies that were out there. But I guess there is some degrees of freedom within this within the framework. That being said, I think it was there was a bunch of different things. I found it interesting to see the way that different people changed, like May, for example. I guess in some ways she didn't change, but at the same time, I don't understand the personality changes, I guess, that happen in the framework. I see when people get put into it, but they never really explained how Ada changes the people when they get in there as well. I understand the idea of changing the circumstances or a regret or something like that, but to actually make fundamental personality changes as we see in Fitz and May sort of have me scratching my head. I understand Coulson, you know, he's not necessarily a leader anymore, and he's just, you know, just a teacher, and that sort of made sense. And even but some of the other sort of fitting in how I guess Daisy, as we might say, or Sky, is a Hydra agent and stuff like that. It all, some of the stuff fit and some of the stuff didn't, so I wish there was a little bit more explained about how people changed when they went into the Matrix. Well, or I guess framework. Sorry, I guess I shouldn't say Matrix. wrong franchise. Yes, I know. So that being said, I like the interaction. I like the idea that Daisy and Simmons did find each other and are going to, you know, hopefully, you know, move forward together and try and do their plan. I was shocked when I guess Ada figured out their back door, and I can't say I quite understood it all, but it definitely does raise the tension that there's no escape seat or anything like that to get out of this, and now they're stuck in dealing with it. And it's interesting that I, as far as I can tell, Ada has taken Fitz as a pet. And yes. that's sort of has me scratching my head, and I'm really not sure how this is going to work out. They really don't seem to be giving a clear path. Oh, if we do this, then X will happen. So it's very nebulous at this point, and I like it. It's the shakeup that the show needs a little bit to keep going and stay fresh. And while I'm not sure about the ratings, I definitely have to say they're putting it on a very quality show with this Hydra concept. So I wasn't expecting to see Hydra back again, but boy, it's fun.
Yeah, it really is. I'm not even going to lie. I'm enjoying, even with some of the questions, like you said, like how does this work that some of these people are so fundamentally changed. I don't really know that I care. I'm having too much fun with it. So yeah, I definitely feel like this is a great start to this particular arc. I love some of the characterizations. I think it's great that they found a way to bring back Ward. I never in a million years thought that they would pull that off. Or even have it in their plans. But boy, I'm actually happy with it because it's another variation on the theme, which is really fun. So I am really enjoying this particular storyline. I hope that they continue to knock it out of the park. All right, next on the list, while I am talking about that, I should probably give the other comments on this particular episode. excuse me, as I try and get the page to come back up. Thank you. Henry gave this one a 9.5, saying, "It's been a month since Self-Control aired, and perhaps going with a season premiere-like two-hour episode would have been excessive, but at the end of this episode, I felt there was more material left on the floor. Obviously, that material would be aired in subsequent episodes, but everything that happened here was so good that I wanted desperately for it to continue." Can't argue with that.
No, no, I agree. I was waiting for more, yeah.
Edmund, on the other hand, giving it a horribly low 8.5.
Jeez, Edmund, what the heck is wrong with you?
Oh, jeez. Yeah. No wonder he got 100. Yeah. Anyhow, a decent start, but I felt a tad underwhelmed. I put this down to being so jazzed when this arc was introduced in this first installment having some plot-itis as they had to introduce all the new elements, hoping it settles into what I hoped for as the story progresses. So, okay. He's basically hedging his bets. I can understand that. Nothing wrong there.
I didn't feel it was pilotitis, because even though they were introducing a lot of things, I felt like I knew them all already, so it wasn't like a, you know, it was just a, like a last week on so-and-so, rather than actually setting everything up from scratch, because I, you know, we sort of knew what Hydra was, we understood the basic premise and stuff like that, so I didn't quite feel that pilot aspect that he was saying, but I understand how it definitely was, you're scratching your head, as I said, when people are assuming roles you're not familiar with them to assume, so, yeah.
All right, coming in at number two this week, we had Legion, Season 1, Episode 8, Chapter 8. In the season finale, David faces his biggest challenge yet. So descriptive.
Jeez. Should be an AMC
episode. It came in at an average of 9.75. Which normally would be enough to get you number one, but it didn't. It was in a tie. Edmund gave this one a 10, saying, "These are his random notes immediately upon viewing. His girlfriend Syd Barrett? Of course Pink Floyd's going to pop up at a crucial and oh-so-appropriate time. Oliver in the Andromeda strain tube, telling off the automated warning as we all wanted to the first time around. Missed the laser zaps, though. Now they're even taking the Marvel post-credits sequence to a whole new level. Okay. Hamish Link... Finally, I can see past the taint of being Sorkin's idiotic straw man in Newsroom Season 2, all starting with the Jerry Cornelius suit and cane. Zip gun in Season 2, perhaps? I'm sure that if I had read this right after, but somehow this actually works as commentary 2 weeks later for Legion. Yes, this is one of those tens that acknowledges this show just hit all my buttons. Maybe some can find bits and pieces to niggle about, but for me, it took the elements it set up, played them out with beauty and verve and style, tied off the arc nicely, and then left me groaning and begging for more. All in the best way. Thank you, Noah Hawley. Thank you, FX. Thank you, Marvel, for letting these folks play in your sandbox." Really, I can't say more than that.
So he didn't think it was lousy. Okay, I got you.
He's just giving it a 10 out of pure pity. I thought it was a great end to the arc. I don't know how far you've gotten, Gary, if you've actually been able to watch.
No, I'm up to 6. As I said, when I was ill with fever, this show literally made no sense, and I've been catching up, but I'm not quite there yet. So, but that's good to know that I have a strong finish to look forward to. So,
That's right. And I'll just say it is a great ending. And it's actually a really interesting thing, because, you know, this was, of course, airing the same night as The Expanse, and so very often I would watch The Expanse and then Legion the next day. And it was a really interesting inversion, because... The Expanse, we've mentioned many times, it's such a rich world that you could see characters coming, weaving in and out of that story without really missing a beat. It's got that whole Game of Thrones thing going for it, right? Where you can just spend an episode with just two or three characters, and you're not really going to miss too much because it's such a really rich, deep universe. Meanwhile, this show is all about characters. Just this handful in getting into their head, specifically David's.
Yes.
And so it was this really nice thing of this expansive world, no pun intended, and then really this very insular, psychological type of story. So really good stuff. Really glad that this came up towards the top. 9.75. I think this will probably be a contender for the top show for the year. I think so. I mean, with the scores that it's been getting. So, all right, but that brings us to the number one show, and Gary, I'm going to let you take the honors on this one because I'm sure that you really want to take this and run with it.
Oh, geez, yeah. You know, I've been a fan of this show since the get-go, and what a satisfying ending. We're talking, of course, about Grimm, Season 6, Episode 13, The End. In the series finale, Nick must look to his ancestors for strength to save the world from a terrifying end as he faces off against a seemingly unbeatable foe. I pulled all the strings and gave it a full 10 myself. Yes, I will admit that... the sort of reset at the end was a bit cheesy, and I felt that, but this just pulled the entire series together for me, and it just capped off everything. You know, every season now, like, it feels like they wrote this whole series from beginning to end like 7 years ago, because it just dovetailed so well. I mean, we have, you know, we had his mother come back, his aunt come back.
Yeah, surprising. That was really surprising.
Oh, geez. And they just all just started, you know, going on them. And this sense of, you know, family supporting you. And, you know, it makes you think back to, oh gosh, as he's reading back about all these Grimms throughout time, and everything, you know, seemed to come together. And they were back in the, you know, when they were, you know, back at the original scene, where everything had started to happen in the first episode. And it was just amazing that they literally brought Nick down to his knees, where he was just, you know, so close to just giving up and giving up the staff to the guy. And just, you know, he's seen literally all his friends just slaughtered and killed in front of his very eyes, and he couldn't do anything about it. And you just felt the depth of him just almost totally giving up. And then he rallies and ends up defeating it. And when he defeats him, he rewrites time back to when the guy came through the portal. Oh, it was just amazing. And then, as if ending with everyone back alive was not enough, and you would have said, thank you for this series, it was a great ending, I love it, oh great, then they give you even more. Then we flash up then we flash up about, I'll say, 15 years, and then we see all their children now in a trailer with all the, you know, Grimm books and some of the swords and axes, and, you know, is it Diana and Kelly. Yeah. Diana and Kelly getting ready to go out and fight some creature, and then they say, oh yeah, and give the triplets a call too. You're like, oh snap, yes, no, this was great. What a nice little cherry on top of the wonderful dessert that this show ended up being. It's reinvented itself at least 4 to 5 times throughout its run, with taking different angles. And this show that we talked about, season one being this creature of the week show, you know, while it, in some ways it still stayed that, became so much more throughout it. We had the sense of, you know, camaraderie coming together. Enemies became friends. Enemies became lovers. Enemies became friends and then turned again. You know, that and this overwhelming sense of support and family that was in this show. I try to think of a parallel, and I want to say Being Human reminded me of that, where the characters were just so close together that it really was family. And that's the same feeling I get with these actors in this show, that, you know, you really have this sense of, you know, love and support amongst the characters. And it just got better and better every season. And I'm sad to see it go. I really enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed watching it with my family, which, you know, as they're starting to mature, they can handle this stuff a little bit better. But it was really a good, enjoyable show. And I rarely walked away feeling I was cheated. Some of the love triangle stuff in around season 3 and 4 got a little bit crazy, but they you know, they held through and pulled it out. And I'm really thrilled with the way this series developed, and that they were given a chance to to wrap literally almost everything up in one fell swoop, and it all just came back together again. You know, everything from the keys to the stick to the prophecy of the children to the just everything. It all just came together wonderfully. Am I being too hard on it?
You're being horribly hard on this.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how you could possibly.
And you know what? Wu lived at the end. Go figure. Swore he would have gotten it at least more than half a dozen more times than he actually did.
So I do have one question for you. Because
sure.
I kind of remember that back in the day.
Yes.
You really had a hard time with the whole idea of Nick and Adeline as a couple. And you felt like, it's like, wow, they're really trying to sell us on this whole idea. You think at the end that they pulled that off?
Do I still want him back with Eve? Yes. So, no, I don't think they did.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Okay. Don't get me wrong. I think they convincingly portrayed it, but do I still want him with Adeline? No. And especially as Eve was depowered and stopped being that person who barely said 3 words in the white wig, and you know, started to, I'll say, come back a little bit from where she was at. I still saw that. And I think there was some of that in the ending, in the end episode as well. When Eve was getting ready to almost to sacrifice herself, I think I saw something that was still, at least it was still there. Maybe, I don't know if it's quite as strong as they try to push on it, but I felt like, Nick and Eve still had something. As she was dying, at least the way I see it or read it was, I felt sort of the remorse that things didn't work out with them. Hmm. Was the look that I felt the actor was portraying. So, and it seemed to, as much as as some of the other people getting killed hit him, that one's the actor to me seemed like he reacted much stronger to her death.
Well, yeah, I can see that. Maybe read it a couple different ways. For me, it always felt like, or did feel like, even if they weren't together and those emotions weren't the same as they were before, they had such a history that it would be hard for him not to feel something.
You could be right. It could just be that.
But either way, I think that that's one of the genius things about the way that they played it, is that they kind of gave you something for everyone, the people who never really bought into the whole Edelin thing, and even the people who did and still wanted that older relationship acknowledged. So I think that it was a really well done in that respect.
Well, they brought the character back a lot more. Eve, when they reintroduced her with the white hair and she didn't say four words to anybody, I'm not that person anymore. I don't know if it was a conscious choice or what it was, but for all intents and purposes, and geez, I'm blanking out on what her other name is.
Juliet.
Juliet really was back in the last, I'd say definitely this whole season. It was pretty much her again. And I'm glad they brought her back. As I said, I thought it'd be still a little more sticky with Adeline, but I was glad to have her back, and Eve was kind of gone, really. You didn't have that character portrayal of that new person anymore. I mean, she's talking to everybody, like Rosaline and all that. And, it's just like she's, Juliet again. Obviously, she's still a Hexen Beast, but still, it's not like, Adeline's a Hexen Beast, but she's still, relatable and gives more than three-syllable answers. Mm. So, it was nice to see that come back, and maybe that was, I don't know whether it was intentional or not. I think it sort of was to humanize her a little bit more, to make her more likable as a character, because she was being played so flat. So, I'm glad they did it, though, and I don't need an excuse or a reason. I'm just happy it happened.
Okay. I'll say I gave it a 9.5. It was just that time loop thing at the end that really kind of got me.
Yeah, I'll admit I didn't see it coming from anywhere. And obviously the writers wanted to give us a happy ending.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of knew they were going to have to do something when they really started killing people off, because it's like, okay, there's no way they're going to kill off everybody.
Oh, yeah, there's one thing to kill off one, maybe even two, but when they went for the whole cast, yes. Yes.
It's like, okay, they're going to get their cake and eat it too. That's kind of the way that it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Great show, I'll miss it.
Yes, the contrast between the feelings of the end of this season for Grimm versus the end of the season for Sleepy Hollow, very strong. All right, so I'm just wondering if, as we go down the list, rest of the list here, was there anything else that you really wanted to dig into?
Oh, gosh, yes. It's even though it didn't rank high enough to make the top three this week, it's still my favorite show on television right now, The Expanse.
Okay, and this would be The Expanse, Season 2, Episode 10, Cascade. Holden leads his crew through the war-torn station on Ganymede. Boy, that leaves a lot off, but this one came in at an average of 8.5, so still very strong. I'll go ahead and give Edmund's comments here. Something of a setup episode, establishing conditions on Ganymede and bringing Avasarela and Bobby more into each other's orbit. But hoisted by Bobby's breakout, which did a great job fleshing out why life on Mars makes Earth so alien. A lovely mix of character as well as world building. That says a lot of what I was probably thinking of there. But yeah, go ahead, Gary, your thoughts on this episode.
It's as you said, I want to say that the world was built out, but they really keep doing that. Now we've got this, they've built out other stations before, but now we're really getting a good sense of this, of Ganymede. And it's a little different. It seemed like it was a little bit more organized and running better than some of the other stations that we've seen so far in the solar system. And at least until the disaster happened. And just about every place except Earth is pretty miserable from what I'm seeing so far in this universe. So why people keep leaving it are beyond me. That being said, yes, the Martian soldier defecting, escaping rather, was interesting. And she was just sitting there wanting to look at the ocean and the sky and the birds and things that we take for granted are wonders to her. And it's I don't know if I could quite put myself into her mindset, but at the same time, I can understand what an overwhelming thing that could be for somebody who's used to growing up in, in caves and a dome of some sort. So, that was interesting. And the fact that she was willing to break out to make it happen was also interesting. And I wonder if first it was that the only reason she was doing it. She obviously has misgivings about how she's being treated by command. And, I wonder. I have seen the episode since then, so I don't want to put too many cautionary things in it. But I do wonder: was her intent just literally to get out to see the ocean, or was there something else driving her even then? So that we'll have to wait and see. The political dynamics on the planetary scale are very interesting as the ministers continue to meet and discuss amongst themselves. And I wonder if that's how it is played in the real life, where you sort of are dealing with concepts literally so huge, such as war between planets, that you have to take somewhat of a relaxed view of it, because it's just so mind-bending otherwise. So once again, they continue to do a good job. Jeez, I didn't even talk about the Rosinte at all, but I felt that they were almost secondary this episode, so I'll let it go there. You liked the episode as well, John. What point stuck out for you?
Well, I really think it was... I like the fact that now Vassarala has caught up with the audience. She knows about as much as we do, and now she's being our proxy, and she's doing a really good job of it. Kind of really demanding answers, which is great. And I really liked Bobby's story, the fact that she's caught between these loyalties, between, you know, the good for Mars and then the good for just humanity in general. And it's just, I thought both of those points were really strong. I think, like you said, the description talks about Holden, and it talks about the Rocinante, and it talks about Ganymede. But for me, the real story in this episode was back on Earth. That was the story that really mattered to me. And the rest is just kind of percolating in the background, and will find its moments very shortly. There's 3 episodes left in the season, so.
Oh, is that all? Oh, no.
Yes, only 13, sorry. But it's a good one. So there's that.
There is that, yes.
If I were going to say something here, I would probably, I do want to give a shout out to Black Sails, season 4, episode 10. That would be 38.
Okay.
All right. Flint makes a final push to bring England to its knees. Silver seals his fate. Rackham confronts Rogers, and Nassau is changed forever. This was the series finale for Black Sails. I wanted to give this one, came in at an average of 8.75. I only gave it an 8, but Edmund gave it a 9.5. He said, really enjoyed the chances they took with this ending. The show has made a point of highlighting the tales men tell to influence each other into themselves. To end with Silver in the ever mellifluous... Oh, man. I need him to say these things himself.
Yeah.
Jack Rackham, spinning the greatest one yet to firmly cement the legend of Captain Flint is glorious. Regardless of the reality of what happened in that clearing, giving the viewers and the contemporaries who only hear it such an emotionally resonant conclusion to Flint's story was an inspired case of eating your cake and having it too. To use Unca Harlan's preferred and correct construction. They did a glorious job giving these characters depth and humanity and honored that to the end. So, yeah, good comments from Edmund. It really was a strong episode. For me, it was just a slightly oddly upbeat version. I didn't maybe take into account that they were playing around with this idea that the upbeat finale was more the way that things were being spun. But that's an interesting take, and maybe I just missed it. But regardless, it really synced up well with Treasure Island as a prequel. And, you know, I like the fact that it really fulfills its purpose. So, yeah. As a prequel, it manages to do that while also wrapping up all the things that it had back in its own storylines. So, good for Black Sails for going out strong.
Mm.
Let's see. Any other episodes that you want to delve into?
I guess we could talk about Walking Dead.
Okay. That would be The Walking Dead, Season 7, Episode 16, The First Day of the Rest of Your Life. The stakes keep mounting higher and higher as different stories clash while the group enacts an intricate plan. Really? They did, huh? This one came in at an average of 7.67, and this will officially be the lowest scored or average for a season of The Walking Dead in quite a while, unfortunately. Your thoughts on this one? You actually gave it the highest out of all of us, an 8, which, you know, not huge, but still.
Yeah, I liked the surprises with, what's her name? I like the surprises of the junkyard group, I guess you'd call it. Turning. Am I thinking the right episode?
I'm sorry, what?
The junkyard group?
Yes.
Turning?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but okay.
Okay, where they turn sides?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
I was
okay.
Misunderstanding you.
Oh, no problem. Where they turn sides out of apparently nowhere. And you think as they were doing that, how Rick went through all that trouble to get all those guns and everything like that. And then... They're going back on it. got a better deal. So that was came as a complete surprise to me in this version, and I wasn't expecting that. And then to have Sonya, is it? Sonya die like that was just Sasha. Was just surprising, and honestly, I didn't get it at first, or at least I think I didn't get it. Maybe you could tell me if I did for sure. She took Eugene's pill.
Yes, correct.
Okay, I wasn't 100% sure, or gosh, do I actually believe Eugene about the airtight coffin? And I was like, no, but it did. I'll admit I was a little slow on the uptake on that to figure that out. Although I still can't understand why they were transporting her in a coffin to begin with.
Yeah, because that gets into all the reason why I felt like this was only a 7.5. There's so many little things that they did that didn't quite add up, and I'm starting to feel like they need new blood when it comes to the directors for this show, because while Greg Nicotero is really good at the effects and so forth, mm-hmm. I don't know that he can handle all the demands that the scripts are asking of him. And the action sequence in this particular episode, I feel like you get a different director in there that knows more about how to do these kinds of gunfights and stuff. And I think you get a much better and tighter episode overall.
Yeah, the angles were really screwy in this episode.
It really did not make sense.
I mean, I'm not saying I needed a shaky cam, but I was like, you couldn't tell where the action was happening half the time. It was very confusing.
Yeah, it wasn't the most straightforward of directing jobs, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, I'll go ahead and let Edmund throw in his comments here as I try and pull my own thoughts together. The score might have been higher if I'd entered it right after viewing, but it didn't stand up to further scrutiny. The Battle of Alexandria, as AMC's email trumpeted it the next day, was poorly shot. That's exactly what we're saying, right? Lots of people striding down the street shooting at people you couldn't see. And while they avoided another cliffhanger, I still feel like Chekhov's Lucille got short shrift again. She was promised one, and Negan shrugging off Eugene's latest faux genius rationalization and revealing he knew damn well who gave Sonya the potion could have really kicked off this war. Or it's actually Sasha, that's what probably threw you off. Anyway, especially if he'd whacked Eugene out in front of the assembled troops to demonstrate how we just can't trust these people. Except for that would go completely against how things go in the source material. So they're really adhering pretty closely. In fact, this episode really did kind of play out the way that it was in the comics. It was just rearranged slightly.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest problem is that the more that they play these games with getting one over on Negan, the less effective he is. There's absolutely no reason why Rick is still alive right now.
Oh, no. He should have been dead the second time, at least.
Yeah. There's so many different ways that Negan could have got one over on them. First of all, like you said, the leader of the trash heap people, whoever they are, should have just shot him.
Yeah.
That's what should have happened. It's just like, because they're trying to like, it just doesn't quite work. And maybe it's partially the source material, that the source material kind of forced it at this point in the story too. I vaguely recall feeling the same way, that it's like, boy, you're really making Negan look weak in order to keep Rick looking strong. But I feel like we've had that argument before with Rick, is that, sometimes you've got to weaken everybody else just because he's not the most effective leader. And Negan came out swinging and strong at the beginning of the season, and now we've got someone who I feel is a bit watered down, so.
Well, think about it. He came on so strong, and now we see, think about all the different people now. He hasn't killed that he should have over time. What's it? The boy, Carl, he should have killed. He should have killed, who else? He should have killed, Sasha, honestly, breaking in there with guns to try and kill people.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm going to make at one point. I mean, there's so many different times that he should have just done it just to make a statement, if nothing else.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how they played it, because, originally when they sort of introduced him, they tried to imply that the reason he was coming down so hard on the Alexandria people was because of what they did when they killed the outpost people. And that wasn't necessarily, he wasn't quite all that bloody all the time. But then they show us episodes like when they throw the scientist into the burner to reinforce that he is that bad. But then we see time after time now, with Rick, with Carl, with Sasha, and the like, where he doesn't do anything, and it's very inconsistent.
It's very inconsistent, and it weakens him as a villain. They need somebody who, he basically, what it is that they brought him out, and the biggest selling point was that he is playing by a very strict set of rules. And that is why he does what he does, is because he is, you know, essentially enforcing rules, and as long as you work within the rules, you're fine. But then it's toothless if people break the rules and he doesn't follow up exactly the way that he said that he was going to. It completely undermines the whole point of him being such a terrifying villain. And yeah, I feel like, as much as I like the performance, I feel like they are not doing him any favors right now.
We also have the hindsight, well, not hindsight, but, you know, if they continue to adhere as much as they have been lately to the source material, we sort of know where this is going at the same time, and maybe that's sort of some of the issues that we're having as well, because we know. Do you find that when you're watching the show that, you know, well, if they follow the source material,
yeah,
I know where this is going, and it seems like they are. So that's okay, because I know this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I feel that way quite a lot right now.
And it does, and it's been this season in particular seems like they've been staying so rigid to the source material that I feel that more than I have in previous seasons.
I believe that, yes. I think that
I hope they veer off a little bit more, you know, and do things that necessarily aren't, not just to shake up the people who are reading the comic books, but in a sense to put some originality into it. When you're basically writing off a pre-done script, it's not as imaginative, I guess.
I can see that. The adaptation is so straight up, and they're not doing anything to compensate for that, and it weakens it across the board. That and the fact that the pacing this season was so bad, so slow, that for them to do this so straight up doesn't work as well, because there's no build up of anticipation for it. Mm. Things are just kind of happening, and they're happening very slowly. I mean, the second half of the season they came back from that mid-season strong and then killed it, the momentum, entirely. To the point where I know people who watched this episode and didn't even realize it was a season finale, because it just didn't feel like anything had happened yet. 8 episodes and people still felt like barely anything happened. But yeah, I mean, 7.67, not a horrible score, but for The Walking Dead, that's much lower than we're used to.
Yeah.
I don't know much more that we can say about it. Anything else?
No, I think that's about it.
Do you want to go through? Because then we can probably do... Oh, go ahead.
No. I was just saying... No, I'm good. If you wanted to wrap up some of the others, go through the rest of them.
Running a little longer than what we've been doing recently, so let me just go ahead and bring up the list again. And we can get started. Come on, computer. Come on, computer. There we go. And we'll go ahead and start with Arrow, Season 5, Episode 18, Disbanded, came in at an average of 9. So that was in a tie for third place, so good episode of Arrow, actually one of the better ones recently. The Americans, Season 5, Episode 5, Lotus 1-2-3, came in at an average of 8.25. Edmund said about this one, some interesting twists, but a rare case of the audience's 21st century hindsight putting us ahead of the characters. Henry's aptitude, I'd already anticipated, of course. Constantly playing on his computer was too big a clue for those who knew where kids who did that in the 80s wound up. And while I didn't anticipate the crop guy's reveal, having him working on Roundup-ready crops had a lot of resonance, and some future hindsight as well. I wonder if he maintained his principles and resigned once he learned the company planned to make the seeds sterile and force farmers to buy them again each year. Overall, just moving the plot ahead incrementally, but certainly adding to Philip's shakiness in their mission. Meanwhile, Stan's gambit seems to have left Oleg off the hook for now, and the Russian version of the dating game was a hoot. Yes, I have to agree, it was a strong episode, again getting an 8.25. The 100, Season 4, Episode 8, God Complex, came in at an 8. The Magicians, Season 2, Episode 10, The Girl Who Told Time, got an 8. Colony, Season 2, Episode 12, Seppuku, got an 8. The Originals, Season 4, Episode 3, Hunter of Ruins, got an 8. Into the Badlands, Season 2, Episode 3, Red Sun, Silver Moon, got an 8. iZombie, Season 3, Episode 1, Heaven Just Got a Little Bit Smoother, also got an 8. Legends of Tomorrow, Season 2, Episode 17, Aruba, the season finale, came in at a 7.83. 24 Legacy, Season 10, Episode 10, 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., got a 7.5. Designated Survivor, Season 1, Episode 14, Commander-in-Chief, got a 7.5. Outcast, Season 2, Episode 1, bad title for anything, is an a 7.5. Riverdale, Season 1, Episode 8. The Outsiders got a 7.5. And finally, last but not least, Supernatural, Season 12, Episode 16, Ladies Drink Free, got a 7.5. So, wow, long list to go down for this particular week. But, yeah, it was a lot of material, a lot of good material. All right, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this particular episode, and the next time when we come back, we're going to catch ourselves up on our episodic discussion. So, until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.